Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door.
I'm not even gonna swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know and they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Wait right there, Mr. Pinnell.
How do you know my name? I didn't tell you my name.
Hang up.
I didn't tell them my name.
They're all a part of it. They're all parts, all of them.
Do you ever wonder about all the different ways of dying? You know, violently. I wonder, like, what would be the most horrible way to die?
It's not my intention to do this in front of you. For that, I'm sorry. But you can take my word for it. Your mother had it coming.
Mommy, I want to see the bad man fly.
Make the bad man fly!
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
I just can't take no pleasure in killing them.
Just some things you gotta do. Don't mean you have to like it.
Seven days.
Wait a minute. I know who you are. Yeah, but I heard you were dead.
And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming. And the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts tonight, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and tonight is a second part of a two-part episode on the film Escape from Tomorrow, with Abe co-hosting with me, and special guest Christy Schoonover-Peterson, who was the author of Skeletons in the Swimming Hole, Tales from Haunted Disney World, which fits perfectly into tonight's topic. Escape from Tomorrow is a film that was filmed in Disney World and Disneyland, guerrilla style, by director Randy Moore. And this was his first feature-length film. I know if anybody that hasn't heard of this film, they can get it right now on Netflix for free. It is actually an interesting film that we discuss thoroughly in this latest episode. However, if you prefer, you can go back to episode 144, which is part one of this two-part episode where we discuss various things about Disney World, Disneyland, related to horror and the horror field, as well as questions for Christy, who, once again, has written a book about ghosts and Disney World, Disneyland. So definitely worth checking episode 144 out. So with that stated, let's get into the new episode. This episode, episode 145. Unfortunately, co-host Mike was not able to make it due to a car accident his wife got into right before the episode was to start, and he had to go and pick her up. She is okay. No injury to her, though her car would have to go to the repair shop. Also, co-host Eric was unable to make it because an hour prior to the recording of this episode, he was called in to work. He was on call, and he works on computers and had to go take care of that. So, without any more interruption, let's begin the episode. Episode 145, part 2 of Escape from Tomorrow.
We'll be right back.
he'll say? Bad things happen everywhere. Especially here. I can't be happy all the time.
Something's wrong with Elliot.
There's something going on here.
It's this place!
You're inside my head!
You've got quite an imagination!
Just like old W himself.
Daddy, let's go home.
I mean, the film's message itself, like going back to the actual message of it, if you look at the storyline, and I'm sure we're going to get into it, but if you look at the storyline, you have a man who's clearly distressed and is losing his mind. And so this falls under the category of magical realism, in which both the character and the reader are not really sure what's happening. So to the character, it's real, but to the reader, it could very well be a hallucination. And with this man, with this main character, Jim is his name, suffering as he is, the Parks are his adversary. They're not a fun place to be at this point in the main character, Jim's life. So the whole evil plot thing that they were like, oh, he's commenting on Disney and the, it's like, well, that was actually, in my opinion, that was Jim's mind making a metaphor for how he feels about being in the parks at this particular time. And, you know, so, and in the end he gets sick, which further leads us to believe that he had problems all along. So again, I think this was more of a comment on not the culture of Walt Disney World, but a comment on the human condition, on our culture's desire to try to create a utopia where we can go, where there are no problems. And it's also a strong commentary on the family vacation, the family dynamic. You could easily tell this exact same story in SeaWorld. You could tell it in Universal. You could tell it in the Museum of Natural History. Anywhere that people go to escape, you could tell it.
And so, to be honest, the National Lampoon's Vacation, right? It's a comedy.
Exactly.
It's a simple idea of a guy that's stuck in a situation that he doesn't necessarily like, and he kind of has a breakdown, but it's a comedy rather than a dark comedy or a dark film like this film.
But the idea is almost the same in a way, just different approaches in tones.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
It's just like, no matter where you go, you know, it's, nothing can go, go as planned, you know, there's no complete safe place that we can, even in our own head sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just shows you just how vulnerable humans can be, you know, and as we saw here that the place of, you know, the Disney is always, you know, shown to be is a, you know, fun place, you know, when a person's put under stress or just having a really bad time, even then it's not a comforting area. You could just exacerbate things to such a degree that it could drive someone insane. You know, it can be pretty stressful, you know, waiting in line for hours,
yeah.
The huge crowds and, you know, tension, stuff like that. It's just how, people are, you know, sometimes, you know, we can only take so much of, you know, huge crowds or heavy situations.
And I want to use a quote from Henry David Thoreau from his book, Civil Disobedience and Other Essays. He wrote, "Most men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to the grave with the song still in them." And that's what National Lampoon's Vacation was kind of saying, probably unintentionally. While this film here, most certainly was trying to say it. And why not use the quote-unquote, as you said,
Christy, Happy Utopia. I mean, in theory, they could have used, you know, any Hawaii, you know, Honolulu. It could have been anywhere. But why not use the place that no one is supposed to be sad to have this guy's life unravel? And so I would agree that it, even though it can be used as a commentary on Disney and what Disney represents or pretends to represent, I think this film is more than that and is more attributed to the simply the Henry David Thoreau comment and what you said, Christy, the human condition in general.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, I mean, as much of a park freak as I am, I have been to Walt Disney World many, many times, and I have had some unhappy days in Disney World. I absolutely have. I will totally cop to that. I've had days in Disney World that were totally crappy. I had a day on my honeymoon where we actually call it like the third. There's a name for it, actually. The cast members actually have a name for it. It's like the third day blues or something. I can't remember what they call it. But like on the third day, you start having arguments because you're hot, you're tired, you're like, rah, you know. So I've had days at Disney that were not pleasant. And what's interesting about that is that because Disney World creates itself to be the happiest place on earth, you actually feel guilty when you're not happy in Disney World. Like, I'm sitting here and I'm looking around going, I'm in the happiest place on earth and I feel like shit right now. I'm angry or I feel sad or, you know, whatever. And I'm miserable. And it creates this feeling of inadequacy. Like, what's wrong with me? You know, it really. So that's one of the things that really appealed to me about this film is that they were also showing kind of the ugly side that people go through. You know, not everybody there is happy. And certainly I've seen my share of other people that are not happy in the parks as well, besides myself. Now, most of the time I love Disney and I'm happy every minute I'm there. But, you know, you do get your days sometimes where, you know, your old demons come back to haunt you. Or, you know, I would miss my mom sometimes if I went on a certain ride. And then I'd get really depressed that she wasn't there and that because she's dead and blah, blah. And then I got to go to Epcot and drink to get rid of it. So, you know, it's like, I think that's really what this movie's about. But that's why it's cool, because it's so subjective. You know, you could talk about the theories for hours, but.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we'll do that. So the reason this film honestly probably got the popularity, I guess the word to use, is probably specifically because of how it was filmed in the Disney, quote-unquote, wrath. So in other words, this guy, Moore, he was interviewed on all the morning talking head shows, the cable news shows and whatnot about this film, what makes this guy's small, independent, low-budget horror or urban fantasy or whatever type of genre film you want to call it, get that type of press when we have, you know, plenty of other great films as well that are genre-related that, you know, the press wouldn't even touch because it's like, who cares? Never mind just regular films. And that really comes down to the fact that Disney, no one has ever done it like this before, and as a result, it got that press. So with that all stated and how he did the film and the notoriety that it got because of where he did the film, the question is this a good film, and did we like it? So, Abe, let's start with you. What is your opinion of Escape from Tomorrow, the film?
Huh. Well, it in a way feels very similar to Plus One in the sense that it takes a while to really build up to the most interesting parts of the film. It starts off very slow. I was also surprised that it was filmed in black and white as well. But I guess it was used to in its form to hide certain things as also come kind of to maybe set the mood. And you know, at first I felt really mixed about the film as a whole, but, you know, having a little time to think about it and, you know, the entire history behind it and, you know, what the director went through to try to make it, it's actually a very intriguing film. And it does, you know, bring up a lot of interesting topics, not just what is in the film, but in another top and other things you can probably expand upon, because, you know, it's a kind of type of movie that you can build a type of different theories and, you know, have great discussions on. So I thought it was really interesting. But it, you know, I was hoping to, you know, wait to bounce it off with everyone else to see how they felt, you know, because I did have some questions.
Okay, no, that's fair. That's fair. For me, the film has a wonderful black humor to it, black comedy. It's absolutely hilarious at points.
Yeah.
And that surprised me because I you know, because it was marketed as a true horror film, and I know, Christy, you corrected that, or you corrected as much as you can when it's ever spoken of on Facebook or other places, and you call it a urban magical fantasy, and you know what, you're probably right, and it really isn't a true horror film in the sense that horror fans would prefer. However, it does have some horrific elements, and it is a genre film, so it still qualifies as speculative fiction for sure. For me, I actually, even though, Abe, you said it was slow the first hour or so, and again, when we did the upcoming Wolf Creek episode, which hasn't been released yet, we discussed how that film, the first Wolf Creek, how the first hour was slow, and then it picks up hugely after that, and I'm the type of person that likes those slow first hour films, like Red, White, and Blue and Wolf Creek and Escape from Tomorrow have that slow, quiet character study for the first hour. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic, and I was laughing my ass off at numerous parts. Then it does get a little confusing near the end because it suddenly turns into what you call it, Christy, a magical fantasy. And we find out that what we've seen for the first hour may or may not be what it actually appeared to be. And so I was a little confused or maybe even disappointed at points at the second half. But then I did rewatch it and do appreciate it as well. I would recommend it, especially for our art house fans of speculative movies. And I enjoyed it tremendously. I would put it as one of my high recommends for 2014 for speculative fiction films, but it definitely is an acquired taste because of its art house feel and its ambiguity ending in second half. And of course, for those who are looking for a straight horror film, it isn't what you would probably expect. Before we get your opinion, Christy, since you're the big one here for Disney, I'll read Mike's opinion on the film. And
he said something on Facebook like, "I watched it, but I'm not sure what it was." Or yeah. Something like that. He sent me up whatever it was he said.
He sent me an email for his opinion, so I can read it out here. And he goes, while waiting, you know, for Pam to go and pick up Pam because of the unfortunate car accident that her car got totaled. Mike speaks. I thought Edge of Tomorrow was ambitious and deserves full credit for pulling off the ultimate Disney prank. But the main character is an unlikable ass, and disjointed nature of the story, particularly after the intermission, turned me off. In other words, the second half of the film. Only recommended for Disney freaks and fans of low-budget surreal cinema. So that's his opinion. Now, Christy, let's hear what you have to say, because this is the film that you bought on disc. You've seen all the extras. You've been looking forward to this film since it was announced back in the fall of last year. So what's your take?
Yeah, Well, I'm kind of all over the map with it. I absolutely adored certain things about it. The artistry of it was really quite appealing to me. You know, the whole black and white business, for example, as you'd mentioned, you know, they did it in black and white to make it creepier because they felt that color, you know, Disney World is just alive with color. And it's really difficult to tell a dark story with all of that visual noise going on. And it also, like you said, it covered some things. Because they were shooting the same scene over and over, like at Autotopia, what if they got two different color cars on two different days? You know?
Oh, so, that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so the black and white would cover that. And in fact, Randy Moore did say that that was part of his choice. So it was made purely for, I think, practical and aesthetic reasons. But what I loved about the black and white is that it, metaphorically or figuratively, it's a little bit like sepia. It suggests nostalgia. It suggests something in the past. It suggests memory. And here this main character is having a lot of regrets about where he is in this situation, what he's done with his life. And so, but in contrast to that, the Disney parks and the vacations are all about making memories. And so people love to go there and preserve their memories. And they have memories of the last trip. They have memories from their childhood. So I really thought the black and white was a wonderful choice. And that was the first thing that stuck out at me, figuratively. As far as the story, I really think I have to agree. The first time I watched the story, the second half, to me, had some holes in it that I was like, okay, what is that about? Like, it with the scientist.
Yeah, I was confused by that as well. That was
I was very confused. And even now, I've seen this film two or three times since the first time I saw it. And every time, the first time I saw it, I was wowed by it. So I was like, okay, but I don't really understand what went on in that second half. So maybe when I watch it again, I'll figure it out. But sure enough, in subsequent watchings, you know, I really didn't figure out what was going on with the scientist. It was like he was talking about, oh, you've been here before, and that's why we picked you. And my reaction to that was, well, picked you for what? Like, what are they actually doing here? You know, I mean, the scientist says, you know, this was an opportunity to really make clear that right there, this was an opportunity to really tell us. The scientist could have come out and said, we chose you because of this, and this is our plot and our plan. And he says something about his boss, but I'm still not sure what that was. And what did they really want with him? Like, were they stealing memories? Were they banking memories? Were they stealing their ideas? Like, I was like, what are they doing?
I was absolutely flabbergasted as well. And then suddenly he's a robot, too, at that point. And I was like, what? What was going on at this point? I completely got lost after that.
Well, and also you have two different, I almost want to say, and like I said, Phil, I adored this film. I mean, as a whole, I would recommend it for Disney Park freaks. I really enjoyed this film. There were parts where I was laughing out loud. The only reason I'm addressing this issue now is because I think all of us kind of felt the same way. Like, we sort of felt like the second half really wasn't as strong as the first half. I think the business with the robot and the hallucinations, in all honesty, if this had been my film, I would have cut it and stuck with the story of the witch stealing the little princesses and stealing the little girls, because that would have kept it on the whole, this guy's having a breakdown because he sees these two sexy French girls. His wife is, let's face it, his wife is a bitch from the game.
Oh, God, yes.
She is such a bitch. I was just like, oh, my God. You know, oh, my God, did you put sunscreen on her? You know, and then there's that one hysterical moment where she's like, you have 10 minutes. And he's like, well, then what the hell did you put sunscreen on her for?
Oh, and then there's the one, the goddamn necklace, too, the bell.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I was like, are you ungrateful, bitch? Yeah. I'm getting you something in the first place.
Yeah. So I think story-wise, honestly, if they had really just focused on the relationship aspect of the story and kept it to that, keep the thing where he has sex with the witch and she steals the princess and all that. I think the, you know, his little girl, she steals her, you know, kidnaps her, whatever. I think if they had just cut the robot part of it out, I think we would not be having these issues with the second half. I don't know, Philip, what do either of you think about that?
That would be something I would agree with, because basically the witch subplot, which is basically a, we'll discuss some of these plots in more detail, but it's basically this woman who I guess what you would call a hot MILF that has visited the park many times, and we find out that she is similar to him, and except she's the, I guess, the male version. I mean, the female version of him, right. Where she's
completely lost in her fantasy.
Well, yeah. Well, you know what? I don't even think it's that. I think it comes down to the Thoreau quote again, which is, "She's living the same thing. She, instead of most men, you could write most women, or just most people, lead lives of quiet desperation and go to the grave with the song still in them." And she's desperate, and he's desperate, and not necessarily desperate for food or money or anything like that, but just desperate because they're just unhappy people. And so she's basically the unhappy female version of him. And what happens is that plot was interesting, and it was in the quote unquote real world. I mean, basically the whole film was in the real world, where he's basically just breaking down and he's doing his Walter Mitty moments and things like that. But then we have the robot scene, the scientist scene. And again, if they put it in more of a Walter Mitty feel, it could have worked, but because it came out of nowhere and
yeah, it really came out of nowhere.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that was where the problem occurred, is that, yeah, we can look back and go, okay, yeah, we understand that it's just in his mind and it's a breakdown and whatever. But prior to that, we didn't have any of these real dreams, Walter Mitty type fantasies or screw ups, and it came out of nowhere. And so, if that one scene was removed or put into a better perspective, it could have worked. Any further things you guys wanted to say about these things, or should we start getting into some of the story itself, and then we can talk about what we think it means and stuff?
Yeah, I think we can start with the story. What do you think, Abe?
Yeah, let's go. Let's do that.
Yeah, so let's get into some of the scenes. Chrissy, you're offline. You mentioned that you took quite impressive notes on various things in the film, but. Right off the bat, we definitely know this is going to be a dark film, and I'm not talking about because it's we know it's a horror film, but we know it's going to be a dark film or a depressing film or whatever you want to call it, because the first scene, the guy is talking on the balcony of the hotel, maybe the Contemporary. I'm sure you know where it is, Chrissy, but he's on the balcony. He's talking to his boss. His boss fires him. And it's not surprising that his boss is in an English accent, because if we see, at least in Hollywood budget films, the bad person seems to always be an English accent. And that's a running joke. If you go through the internet, type in Hollywood English accent bad guy, you'll see what I'm talking about. And sure enough, the guy says, "Yep, sorry, old boy, I can't help you out. I hope you have fun at the vacation. Goodbye," and he just hangs up. And so the guy immediately loses his job, and his son locks him out on the balcony. And that's how we get an idea what the film's going to be like.
Well, and also, it actually sets the viewer up even before that, Philip, that we know what kind of movie it's going to be, because the opening credit sequence is really pretty brilliant. The way it's put together foreshadows the type of story that's going to be told. I mean, we're riding on Big Thunder Mountain in broad daylight.
Oh, yeah. That's
and then right. When they go into a tunnel, the first thing you get is an image of the Haunted Mansion wallpaper, which is a dark ride. Then they go through, then you're riding again. Then they go through another tunnel, and you get a vision of the clock in the Haunted Mansion. And then they're back in the daylight. And then you get another tunnel, and it's the portrait hallway in the Haunted Mansion foyer and the Haunted Mansion foyer, and somebody screaming. So it's this happy time out in the daylight and this scary time in the dark. And the Big Thunder Mountain sequences are what's going to happen to this guy on the outside, that he's in this happiest place on earth and they're running around doing all this stuff, putting up appearances, being a guy on vacation with his kids. And those Haunted Mansion insert moments represent what's lurking in his mind, his interior self. So they actually set up the entire contrast right in that opening credit sequence.
And also, Chrissy, they imply that someone gets beheaded on the ride.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
right when they go into the cave.
That's right. And then they go back to that later in the film. They reference that. One of the characters says something about getting beheaded on a ride.
And I will tell you this much. Big Thunder Mountain is a longtime favorite of mine. I know exactly in both Disneyland and Disney World where that cave drop is. And believe me, you do feel like your head's about to be taken off. You drop at the last minute. You think you're going to smack into that piece of rock. And everybody always ducks going under it. It's hilarious. It's true. You see everybody in front, like if I love to sit in the back. And so I'll be right in the back and you'll see everybody in front of you. Just they're all putting their heads down when they hit that thing because they're afraid they're going to smack into it. So that really goes to show you too that Randy Moore knew his shit. Like he knows these parks. He knows the rides very intimately. So anyway.
Let's get through the first 15 minutes of film.
Well, and what's also interesting is you're right, Phil. That was filmed at the Contemporary Resort Hotel. They did film it in a contemporary room. I'll talk about the interior hallway, however, in a minute. But those rooms, actually, I stayed in one of those rooms. Those are the Magic Kingdom facing rooms.
Okay.
And they're more expensive. So they really paid a lot of money to be able to have that room for a couple of days. Those rooms for the Magic Kingdom facing are, depending on the time of year you go, they can be as much as $400 a night.
Damn.
Yeah. So that was pretty pricey. But what's interesting too is when he gets this phone call, the score is very funereal. It almost sounds like a funeral dirge if you listen to it, Phil. It really does. And I love the comment of the evil guy going, "Oh, take your kids on Soarin'," because Soarin' was all any Disney freak talked about. You know, because, oh, they say you're really flying. And you really do feel like you're flying. But anyway, so go on. So, and the kid locks him out.
Yeah. So basically what happens is the kid locks him out. Then we get cut to his wife in bed, and she gets a phone call. Basically, his boss hung up on him, and he calls his wife to, "Hey, you got to get me out of here." And so what it is we meet the family. Like you said, it's the wife. Obviously, I said the little boy, and then there's a little girl as well. The little girl, I think, is the youngest. And they basically get on the monorail, and he, meaning the father, looks around, and we see the typical, you know, guy in the background coughing, and everybody's like, ugh. And, you know, so in other words, they're, even though it's supposed to be Disney World, they're throwing in things, which is...
Well, they're setting you up for what happens later. I mean...
Yeah. Yeah.
We see them arguing. We see the wife is a bitch right away. And that hallway scene, that hallway that they're walking down, that was not shot at the Contemporary.
No?
No. That was shot at a hotel in Los Angeles. The thing is, when you have those balcony rooms that overlook the Magic Kingdom, the ones that face the park and the Contemporary, if nobody's ever been there, but I'm sure you've at least seen pictures, it's a giant A-frame. So the interior is this giant foyer. The room doors face the giant foyer.
That's right.
So when they're going through down, you can actually look down after you come out of your hotel room and see the monorail going through the building. You can see the shops. When I was there in 2008, that was when I last stayed at the Contemporary, I was overlooking Chef Mickey's. And they'd have these character breakfasts every morning. I swear to God, they'd start at like 7 o'clock, right? And the girl I was with, her name is Megan. She was a buddy of mine from school. And we were big drinkers. So we were up all night partying and drinking. So we were hungover every morning when we got up. So you'd wake up at 7 in the morning and you'd hear screaming kids and like singing and celebrate, have a good time. And oh, God, that was so rough. It woke me up every morning. But anyway, it was not filmed in the Contemporary. They filmed it in a hotel in L.A. And you know how you can tell? When they get in the elevator, there's a poster on the back of the elevator advertising their hotel's restaurant.
Huh.
It's called the Red Restaurant and Bar at the Pacific Palms Resort, which is in the City of Industry, California.
Man, I gotta watch this again so I can see all these little things here.
It's really cool. And if you want to check this out too, when they're going to the monorail, look up because you can see the room doors. They're like on these balconies. You can see the doors that they would have, you know, walked out on. They're like tiers of a Mayan pyramid, sort of, on the inside. It's hard to explain. You'd have to look at the pictures. But I think it was a very smart choice to not film, because like I said, if you were a Disney freak, if you were not a Disney freak like me, you would not notice it. I noticed it. The second they walked down the interior hallway, I went, oh God, they didn't film that there. that's not where that room would have come out of. But anyway, so they get on the monorail and we're shown shots of people coughing, Phil, like you mentioned. But what's also interesting is that, you know that little quick shot where you see the cast member closing the gates on the monorail?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that was not shot in the Contemporary Resort. That was shot at Epcot. That's the Epcot monorail station. Yeah, you can tell by the garbage can in the background.
Oh my God, that's too funny. But
so they actually mixed that shot. Yeah, it's. I mean, I had a ball with this film because I was just like, oh, that was shot there and that was shot there. And I could tell just by looking at it. But anyway, so they're on the monorail, they pass through the Polynesian Resort, and that's where the two hot French girls get on, and I love this scene.
I want to correct everybody. Everybody thinks they're French girls, but they're Quebec girls.
Oh, they're Quebec girls, sorry, okay.
Yes,
they're constantly called French girls a number of times.
Yeah.
Actually, the mother, it sums it up perfectly, and it's typical Americans, which is, I saw you staring at those French girls or Parisian girls or whatever the hell they are, or, you know, and that's the case. And, you know, it's like whatever they are. I mean, you can tell by their accent that they're Quebecers, but it's not surprising they would be Quebecers than French because Quebec, you know, are like us. And up here in New England, we would fly to New Orleans or Florida or anywhere south just as Quebecers would. And, everybody forgets that there's a Disney in France anyway. So if a Parisian is going to come to Florida, they're more apt to go to Miami or Fort Lauderdale than Disney, just for the fact that they can go to their own Disney in France. But either way, you mentioned, Chrissy, that they see these two Quebec girls.
Yeah.
And they play a big part in this film.
Well, and you know what I love about them? They're so over the top. Like, yeah. They're always giggling and touching each other and holding hands. It's like, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, too, because I've seen, you know, young teenage girls act like that. But I also see that these girls here act that way maybe too much. So what we get is almost a caricature of what a French Valley girl or a French, you know, whatever a French Valley girl would be.
Or they're like in the case of the way they appear to Jim, they remind me of like Lolitas on crack.
Yeah.
Like especially that disgusting thing, which we'll get to later, where they're eating the banana.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. So funny. But there is a lot of sexual stuff going on in this film.
Yeah,
in terms
it's definitely loads of it. Yeah, because it's a theme of like a sexual repression and stuff like that. You know, because you can definitely tell that our protagonist here is absolutely sexually frustrated. You know,
yes, yeah.
You know, his relationship with his wife is absolutely terrible. She won't even kiss him.
Oh, I know. I love when they're in the poo ride. And he's trying to make out with his wife in the back seat and in the back of the vehicle. And the wife is like having this fight with him, not in front of the kids and all this kind of stupid stuff. And then right after that happens, right when that's going on, we see this image of poo with his face just covered in honey. Stop and think about that for a second.
I
was laughing, but I just started laughing because I got it right away. I'm like, that's foul. That is so foul. It's so brilliant. It's so foul, but it's so great. That is just such a subtle, disgusting reference. But right, there's right. two of those. Yeah.
It's like the train in the tunnel in North by Northwest or something like that, where it's you can kind of guess what Alfred Hitchcock or Moore were trying to say in this film.
Yeah, totally. And I love the fact there's a big statement here that probably only Disney freaks would get, park freaks would get. But the fact that the first thing that the director has these characters go, the first place they go is Fantasyland. Okay, now look, if you're a serious park addict and you go to the Magic Kingdom, you do not go to Fantasyland first. Because everybody goes to Fantasyland first. You need to either go hit Adventureland or Frontierland, because those are the busiest in the middle or toward the end of the day.
Now, when you say
Fantasyland, everybody makes a beeline for Fantasyland.
Now, when you say Fantasyland, is that the original Disney? In other words, before Epcot and all that other stuff. Is that where Space Mountain is and all those other places?
Yes. It's the Magic Kingdom. And the Magic Kingdom is divided into different lands. I'll do it quick just to clarify it for anybody who really doesn't have an idea. The Magic Kingdom has separate lands. You enter on Main Street, and it's a big hub, like a wheel. Straight ahead through the castle is Fantasyland, and that's usually where people go first. And Fantasyland is where you have, like, your, the teacups and the Pooh ride. And a long time ago, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea used to be there. Now there's the Little Mermaid. The Mine Train, the Seven Dwarfs Mine Train is now there. It's a small world. Then to the right of Fantasyland, if you're standing looking at the castle, you have Tomorrowland, and that's where Space Mountain and all that stuff is, and the Wedway People Mover. To the left, you have of Fantasyland, if you're standing at the castle, it's kind of weird, the way Disney World is anyway. You sort of have to the left and over, you kind of have like Liberty Square, which is where you have the Haunted Mansion and the Hall of Presidents and Tom Sawyer Island and the riverboat. And then to the left of that, you have Frontierland, which is Splash Mountain. The hell else is over there? Frontierland, Shooting Gallery, Big Thunder Mountains over there. And then to the left of that, you have Adventureland. And that's your Pirates of the Caribbean, Swiss Family Treehouse. The hell else is there? The Tiki Room. So anyway, that's how the park's laid out. So just for anybody that has no idea or needs a refresher, there's your crash course. So moving on.
So 20,000 Leagues is gone?
Oh, yeah. They got rid of 20,000 Leagues. When the hell did they get rid of that? I don't remember. I think it was in the late 90s or the early 2000s. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. They just could not keep up the maintenance on it. It really was falling apart. It was very expensive. It needed significantly more repairs and upkeep than the very similar submarine voyage out at Disneyland, which is still in operation, but now it's Nemo's submarine voyage. It's the same ride that the Nemo ride in Epcot is, except you actually ride in a submarine. But yeah, I miss 20K Under the Sea. Oh my God, I miss that ride so much. It's so awesome.
So basically we got the two Quebec girls that symbolize, many things. They symbolize, as you said, Abe, sexual repression. They symbolize a better life, a more fun life. They symbolize age, meaning, you know, high school being 15 or 18 or 22 again. I mean, they symbolize a lot of things. And so they become a major point of the story until the very, very end. Now, what do we want to discuss next? I'm here.
Phil, well, the next really important thing is the small world.
Oh, yeah. Because
that's really where we start to see this magic realist element come in. Small World, I need to point out that this Small World ride was shot in Disneyland, not in Walt Disney World. Disneyland has an outside entrance to It's a Small World with that big giant facade with the boats and the water canals on the outside. In Florida, in Orlando, all of that is inside. You enter like you would another ride. It doesn't have the nice big giant facade that we see in this film. So that was shot in Disneyland. And this is where we really see Jim's first break. He starts seeing the dolls have demon eyes. They start flashing at him, right?
Yes, getting little evil smiles and dark eyes.
Teeth and fangs and, yeah.
Even his own son, too, right?
Oh, yeah, just these pitch black eyes. I came across that image while I was going through the internet at one point. I honestly thought it was just some random thing someone did on Photoshop at first. But, you know, when I saw it on the movie, I was like, holy shit, I recognize that. I recognize that little moments.
Yeah, they've been using that as one of the promotional materials for the film, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what happens is he's riding the ride, and what's interesting about this too is the way they edited this. The correct order of Disneyland, the Disneyland Small World, is you basically are going on a tour around the world. So each area of the world has a room, if you will. So you have the North Pole, which is first, then Europe, then Asia, then Africa, South America, the South Seas, North America, the finale room, which is where everybody kind of comes together. They have all the dolls from all the different worlds. And there's also a hello room at the beginning and a goodbye room, but those don't even figure into this particular story, so it doesn't matter. But the way that they did it in the film, we're jumping all over the place. We go Europe, Africa, South America, South Seas. He's in Asia when he starts seeing things, but the first doll he sees is in Scandinavia, which is like the flying skater. And it kind of, and basically these things all go through demon faces. And then we go to South America and he sees a mask on the pyramid. In Asia, we see the Korean hanbok child riding like a water buffalo. In Europe, the beefeater guard. In Asia, the veiled musicians. That one was my personal favorite. Those really scared the hell out of me, the way they made them look. And then in the finale room, that's the girl from Holland and the boy from Mexico are kind of together. And then we see the South Seas mermaid. So the way that he mixed that all up, I personally found very interesting because I knew they were out of order when I looked at it. I go, he did this all out of order, which is kind of cool. And all of the effects for the changing of these dolls, according to the commentary, they did it all in Korea. They did their post work in Korea to make those dolls look scary. Yeah. So they said they were having trouble with language barriers and things.
So. That's so funny. Now, Chrissy, let me ask you this, because we see this, and we know this is at the point of view, mostly the whole film, it's the point of view of
Jim.
We have a point at like the midpoint of the film, I think it was the 50-minute, 16-second point, where the Quebec girls are walking by, and his wife sees the Quebec girls, and they look at her, and their demon face appears on them as well.
Yeah, and you know, that was actually a point that I was going to mention when we got to that moment, but that bothered me, because to me, that broke the fourth wall in terms of whose story we were telling.
Yeah.
And it took it out of the magic realist thing. It just didn't belong. I mean, here he's in the Small World ride. He's concealing from his family that he's been fired. He's sexually frustrated. His wife is a bitch. He's seeing these two hot young women running around. His kids are like, I want this, I want that. This poor guy is under so much pressure. And so his wife, he thinks that she says, I hate you. He turns to his daughter, and his daughter actually has black hair.
Yeah, that's right.
And not her usual blonde or whatever it is. And then Elliot's eyes, that's the moment you were talking about, go black. So it's really, this is where, like I said earlier, it's typical of a magical realist piece in that he doesn't at first believe what he's seeing. And in magic realist stories, the characters don't at first accept what they see. You know, he's rubbing his eyes, he's shifting around, he's shaking his head. And this is like his inner guilt or his shame at concealing the secret, and all of this stuff is just building up. It's, you know what it's like? It's like the Telltale Heart scenario. If you think about Telltale Heart, it's like, okay, is that really the heart that he's hearing in the floorboards? Or is it his guilt manifesting in these hallucinations? And that's the problem I had, getting back to what you were saying, where she sees it later on, because I'm like, that shouldn't have been there. Because now you're suggesting that there really is something going on, and that really takes away from the internal story that's being told. So that was a moment that I honestly thought did not belong in the film, but that's just me. So,
no, that's true. I mean, obviously, I see what the point was, because, you know, these girls represented whatever for her, meaning that they were a threat. But again, you're right, it changes perspective and all those things. But during the Small World part, there's a scene, not only, like you said, Chrissy, where we can gather what all this means to him, that he sees these demon faces, whatnot. But then there's even a scene where his wife speaks to him, and we know it's fake because of what she says, and she says, "These aren't your children." You know, basically, she's implying that she had an affair and they're from her lover.
And again, we
know that this isn't really her saying it because of a little dream sequence or breakdown that he has.
What did she say?
Hate's a bad word.
No, Mommy didn't mean it, honey. Something's wrong with Elliot.
Oh, you're not his father.
So, I mean, that was interesting, too, because that's almost like him, even though he has all this guilt about what he's thinking and wants and, you know, where he wishes he is in life, he suddenly is using this as almost a thing where it's just like, you know what, my wife's no good, so I can look at these French girls or these Quebec girls because of this. And in other words, it's almost like he's trying to justify, not just because he's bored or hates his life or whatnot, but he's using, it's almost like he's making things up in his mind to justify that he has the right to look at the Quebec girls. This little false sayings that his wife says about his own children and her fidelity with him, I think.
Oh my God, that's totally brilliant. That never even occurred to me, but you're right.
Yeah, that actually makes more sense in a way.
Yeah.
He would try to give him some kind of a defense or something, because especially if he gets caught or something, you know, because he's already hiding one lie from his family, you know, what's another one?
Yeah, right, exactly. Which is, I guess, you're referring to him not telling the family that he
lost a job, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I guess, what was your guys' opinion of this whole small world thing? It's basically his first breakdown and his first manifestation of his guilt and his justification, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's both things going on there, definitely.
Yeah. I thought it was really clever in a way. I honestly was expecting it to come up, you know, about perhaps, you know, his suspicions were true, though, in some way. Because I was always curious why she was so, the wife was so distant from him, you know, in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I know it could just be one of those, you know, bad marriages, or maybe, I mean, again, a lot of things aren't explained. We don't know how this relationship was prior to the movie, so we don't know. Now, what happens next? What parts do we want to go into next?
Well, basically, they meet outside It's a Small World, and they decide to split up.
Yeah,
because
that's right.
Jim sees the two expats, and he kind of wants to go follow them. So Jim takes Elliot, that's the little boy, on Buzz Lightyear, and the mother takes the daughter on the teacups. And just for point of reference here, again, the Buzz Lightyear sequence and the teacup sequence were filmed in Disneyland, not in Disney World. So the teacups in Disney World have a roof on them. The teacups in Disneyland do not. And in Disneyland, the Buzz Lightyear, they're kind of standing, you can see Star Tours across the way. Star Tours is not in Tomorrowland. It's actually in a different park in Florida. So, just for the heck of it, I thought I'd mention that. But, and the Dumbo ride is also in Disneyland, too, because you can see the Matterhorn in the background, and the Matterhorn is exclusive to Disneyland. But anyway, the main thing that happens next is there's this huge long line at Buzz Lightyear. And I understand that Disneyland lines are usually much longer anyway, but I've never actually had to wait that long for Buzz Lightyear. That was amazing to me. I was like, really? But, you know, we don't know what time of year that they're at the parks either, but Disneyland is always giantly busy. Like, Disneyland is just a huge, there's always long lines at Disneyland, so I guess it's believable. But you know what I found out from listening to the commentary?
What?
You know how the ride breaks down?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Right.
That was a total accident. That actually just really happened, and they happened to
film. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Real life writes a script.
Yep.
They
actually had planned, I guess, to film some stuff in Buzz Lightyear, and it didn't happen. They thought, oh, let's just change everything.
Oh, really? I thought they just pretended that it broke down, and the guy goes, oh, this sucks, so, you know, and he walks out.
Yeah, no, it really happened.
That's
So, they thought it was the most amazing thing. They were like, this is awesome. We actually got a ride breakdown in progress. Let's go. So
now, at that point, they bail out of there, and a couple things happen, right? The wife calls once and while he was in line, and he says, yeah, we'll let you know when we get out. And then she calls again, but he decides not to pick up the phone anymore because he sees French girls and he wants to chase them.
And he chases them past the leaping water, which is very sexual. I mean, that just looks like ejaculate.
Oh, yeah, it does. Oh, my God.
Totally. And so he chases them past that. They go up the ramp to Autopia, and this is where they're standing there eating the bananas and giggling and touching each other as they eat this banana.
Banana.
Yes. I mean, obviously, you know, you get your phallic symbol, and you have the two girls fighting over the banana and fighting in, like, such a girly, sexy way. And
Phallic symbol.
Yes, yeah. Totally. And in contrast to that, we cut to the mother and daughter who are eating lunch at the Tomorrowland Terrace restaurant in Tomorrowland in the Magic Kingdom. And that is, by the way, that was in Walt Disney World. And in fact, what's really interesting about that little section of the restaurant they're eating on is an area outside that only holds a very small number of tables because it's sort of like patios going all the way around the building. And in that particular area is exact where I was 9. I had my first hamburger with mustard on it. And it was so good, I've eaten hamburgers with mustard on them ever since. I put the mustard on my burger by accident.
Oh, well, hey.
That's just a side story. That has nothing to do with anything. But I'm thrilled to see them eating on that. I was like, that's my patio. That's where I always sit. Stupid. But so anyway, she's not, and you can see the mother's disgusted because the kid's not eating. And in contrast, we have these disgusting girls with the banana on the, you know. So I just thought that was really interesting the way they did that.
Yeah. I mean, the filmmaking is just phenomenal. The editing and I mean, especially since everything is, you know, hidden. You know, I mean, it's not like they're right out filming and they can do take after take. They have to really just get it to work correctly.
This is when he has his little Walter Mitty moments when they're in the car.
That's right. So they're in that race car thing.
Yeah.
In Tomorrowland, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's in Tomorrowland.
Yeah, and he and his son are in one of them, the cars, and in front of them is the two hot French Quebecers. And he starts having fantasies that he's driving with the two girls instead of his son. And, you know, by this point, I mean, we pretty much know that this is more than just him falling a couple of hot chicks, but he's really like living the fantasy. And the son asks him, kind of notices that we're following the two girls. And,
oh wait, I think that happens in the People Mover.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, that happens in the next scene, but you're close.
Okay,
this is the scene where he's giggling with the girls, and it's obviously in his mind. It's a Walter Mitty moment. But she's, like, touching his nose, and he's like, oh, you like big noses?
Yeah, he's a total, you know, pathetic dork or whatever.
He is. He's so pathetic. Oh, you like big noses. But then they go – no, then the next scene is, I think, what Abe was also remembering is the Enchanted Tiki Room with that giant phallic fountain.
Yeah. God.
So totally phallic.
There's a couple of things. There's obviously the comment about the wife and with the son, and the son notices that they're following him. There's also the scene where the son throws up, and I think that's at this point too.
Yeah, what happens is they go to the tiki room, and he's sitting across from the girls in the tiki room, and that's where you see the big like ejaculate phallic looking fountain thing in between them. Cause if you've ever been to the Enchanted Tiki Room, there's a fountain that shoots up in the middle, but you can see the people sitting across from you. Cause it's like theater in the round. So they obviously did that for a reason. That was planned. But then they go out and get on the Wedway People Mover. And this is where your favorite comment happens, Phil.
Oh my God.
With the Tina Fey and the, oh my God. Cause that's when the little boy says, why are we following those girls?
Yeah,
and this is where they have that whole conversation.
Yeah, right. It was something like, he says, why are we following those girls? They are pretty, aren't they, Dad? Or something. He goes, well, yeah.
Oh, and I love that bullshit answer he gives them, too. Do you think they're pretty? I was like...
He goes, yeah, so that's your definition of pretty. And he goes, I think Mom's pretty, too. And then the father goes, yeah, I guess she's pretty. I mean, in a Emily Dickinson bookish... Tina Fey type thing. But yeah, I guess pretty, yeah. All right.
God damn.
And that's like, oh my God. It's like, yeah, all right. So
that whole scene, I was just laughing my butt off.
Dad?
Yeah?
Why are we following those girls?
Girls? What girls?
Those girls.
Oh, well, I guess they just like the same rides as we do.
Oh.
Yeah.
Dad?
Yeah?
They're pretty, huh?
Well, you know, pretty? It depends on your definition of pretty. Do you think they're pretty?
I guess.
Well, then there you go. That's your definition.
Is Mommy pretty?
Your mother. Yeah, she's beautiful.
I think so, too.
Yeah. I mean, not in a classical sense, but more in a... Emily Dickinson kind of bookish Tina Fey kind of thing. Yeah, but she's beautiful, yeah.
Oh, and by the way, that was filmed in Walt Disney World because there is no more People Mover in Disneyland.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Yeah. The People Mover in Disneyland, the original one opened in 1967, and... In the late 1970s, they added a speed tunnel to it, and then in the 1980s, they added like a Tron. They took the speed tunnel and they made it like into a Tron thing, because Tron was really hot at the time. But the People Mover in Disneyland in California closed in 1995. So, anyway, and you want to hear a really cool piece of trivia?
All right.
Two people actually were killed on the Wedway People Mover. The one in Disney.
Really?
Yep. They basically got out of the cars. They jumped out of their cars and an oncoming train from the other side hit them and crushed them. And they died.
Damn. Jeez.
Was that at Disney World or Disneyland?
I think that was at Disney World.
Okay.
That's, or it might have been, I'll have to check that actually, but I know that that's true because I'd heard it before, but I actually didn't check it before I came on here, but I know that I've read that before. Just Google it. You'll find it. It's out there. But anyway, then, so after we have this discussion, we see the girls at the Move It, Shake It, Celebrate It street party, the parade.
Yep.
And then that's when we do the Space Mountain, and he chases the girls into Space Mountain.
Right. And the thing is the little boy was probably not supposed to go to Space Mountain based off of what we hear later from the mother. And, of course, he gets sick and he throws up.
I love when he's running him to the garbage can and he sticks to
him. Oh, no. He's still trying to fall. Yeah, still trying to find all the girls too.
Girls are like leaping around like little fairies and doing cartwheels. And then you see him carrying his son head down, running to the garbage can.
Yes. It's in slow motion. The music.
It's a great moment.
So what happens is that he's still trying to follow the two Quebec chicks, and then unfortunately for him, the wife sees him and they meet up. And the wife's this is when we really, really find out the wife's a bitch and not just, like, you know, the thing she did earlier were, you know, like, you could argue that she's a little embarrassed, you know, I don't want to make out, or, well, you know, just typical things, naggy things, nothing big. But this is where she really goes off and says, pretty much attacks the guy for taking the boy on Space Mountain, and then says, we're going back to the hotel room, you know, basically wants to end the day. And the little girl says, I don't want to end the day. And he goes, yeah, well, I'll take her and bring her to the, you know, the ride she wants to go. And his, obviously his real motivation is to try to find the Quebec chicks again. But you could also argue that he's right anyway. It's like, if the boy's sick, okay, fine, you have to bring him back to the hotel room. But I mean, you don't have to end the day because of it. At least right. That's what I thought. So,
right. And then what's funny about that though is, like you said, your motivation is he keeps wanting to follow the chicks as well. Because the first thing he does is go to the Frontierland shooting gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, yeah. And the little girl can't even do that.
Right, right.
And then it's like, all right. Like, my husband Nathan loves that stupid shooting gallery.
Oh, my God.
He loves that damn thing. He'll, like, waste all his dollars playing the Frontierland shooting gallery. And I'm over there like, dude, okay, when you're done shooting things, I'll be in line for Splash Mountain. I'll see you later.
The best part of that whole scene too is when he puts the gun to his head and he goes,
oh, I know, I love it.
Oh, yeah.
And then he thinks about it and says, yeah, that wasn't funny, was it? It was what I thought.
And then they go to the treehouse.
Yep.
He takes them up in the treehouse, and that's actually the treehouse in Disneyland because it's Tarzan's treehouse.
Okay.
And not the Swiss Family Robinson treehouse. And Swiss Family is in Disney World. And also, they just kind of enter from the pavement and go right up the stairs. In Walt Disney World, there's like bridges and stuff. There's like a long way before you actually get to the staircase. But anyway, that's when he's able to spy the two chicks again.
Yeah.
Because he's up in the tree. And then he's like, okay, we've had enough for the treehouse. Let's go.
And, I think, is it the next scene is when he meets the MILF?
Yes. It's at Tom Sawyer Island.
Okay.
They go over to Tom Sawyer Island, and that's where he meets the big fat guy. No, that's when he meets the big fat guy in the wheelchair.
Oh, yeah. The neck brace, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now what's explain this thing here? Basically, there's this big fat guy in one of those motor wheelchair-type things that you see people, you know, drive around at grocery stores and stuff. So he's not necessarily truly handicapped, but he's so big or unfit that he needs the scooter thing to go around. And he has his little boy with him. And what did you guys think of this? Because I obviously it's interesting scenes, and it's almost like the nemesis of the guy. But what was your opinion of these two characters, handicapped man and his child?
I don't know. I mean, in a way, it does kind of slow down the plot. At the same time, it adds to the oddness of the entire scenario. I mean, the guy's one of just many weird, strange individuals he comes across who seems just as going crazy as he is.
Yeah.
But, you know, he in a way, he adds to the film, and at the same time, he kind of slows it down a bit. You know, you could keep him in there and it adds to it, and you take him away, and it takes nothing, and it doesn't really damage the story at all.
Well, we see the guy earlier,
outside
of It's a Small World or something, doing something, but I think, I'm not in the head of the filmmaker, but I will make a very educated guess here based on how much time I have spent in the parks. Unfortunately, this is a stereotype that is prevalent in the parks. You see this all the time. You have these people in these motorized wheelchairs, and obviously they don't use these motorized wheelchairs. You can rent them. Okay, so when you get to the park in the morning, you rent them. And it's like $20 a day or whatever the heck it is. You can also rent a regular wheelchair. On occasion, I have had to rent a regular wheelchair to help people I was with get around or whatever. But I'll never rent a motorized one because it's almost like an automatic stereotype. They're all rude. They're always eating. They're always running over people and crashing into you because they don't normally drive these things. So I'm willing to guess, and it's right on. The guy's attitude is right on. I mean, I see these characters in the parks, and I think maybe Moore was just trying to add to the realism, because any park freak, that's a very familiar sight, and unfortunately, it's a very familiar stereotype that you do run into in the parks. There's just no other way to slice it. You see somebody like that coming with a motorized wheelchair and you run to get away from them because they'll hit you or they don't, you know, they're just not practiced at it. So they're always running people over and everything. And it's a problem, you know, it's definitely an issue. So.
Yeah. And sure enough, what happens is this guy, this disabled person's, boy knocks over the daughter, and I don't know if it's intentional. We never really figured it out or not, but he, meaning Jim, is upset about it. And at that point, we don't know, but as the film goes, we find out that this is like almost a nemesis, because he goes, "Hey, that's that guy that his kid knocked over, you know, our daughter or whatever." Yeah.
Well, and it also creates kind of a plot point, too, because we need to get to the nurse's station so that we can hear all about the cat flu.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah. So they get to the nurse station, and, of course, the nurse is a typical hottie, and he's the
guy that
he is. He's looking down her shirt, you know, seeing the cleavage. He's looking at her shape, you know, in the tight dress and whatnot. And what was your opinion of that scene? Because after they bail out of there, the nurse, unless it's in his mind where he thinks that this nurse or all woman think he's this, you know, big shot hot guy or something, because she starts crying, right? I mean, I didn't get that. Unless it was meant to be him thinking that every hot girl likes him or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's a tough question. I just thought the whole scene was delightfully weird. Like, no coughing, no flu. And I mean, she's almost in tears when she says that, you know? And yeah. It's like, this is just so strange. But I never thought of it the way you described it, but that's quite possible, Phil. Because then she offers him what? She offers him a lollipop, too, which is very, you know,
that's right.
Sexual.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, and I don't know. I had the feeling that it was like she was almost waiting for him to say, "Would you like to come?" or something. But
yeah,
I don't know. What about this thing? The plot point about the cat flu. At this point, you know, it's just almost like a throwaway line, because you know you figure she's just a strange woman anyway, because the things she says and all that. But it actually turns out to be a major plot point for the end of the film, at least in his mind, right? I mean, so we'll get to that when we get to the end of the film.
Yeah, well, that's why I thought, you know, the only reference that you kind of get, which is easily missed the first time around, is the people coughing on the monorail.
Yeah.
And I thought that this was one of those plot points that was so pivotal to obviously the way the film ends that we really needed to see at least one other reference before this that's kind of clear. Yeah. So that when she brings it up, it's not like, oh, okay, what the hell is the cat flip? Like, maybe if he'd seen a sign in a bathroom or something, because there's a sign on the wall in the little infirmary that they go to.
Yeah.
But maybe we should have seen a reference to it prior to this.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, but I just remember the first time that I watched this film, I remember going, cat flu, that's weird. And then when it came back at the end, I kind of felt like, okay, but they didn't really build that up enough for me to justify this ending. Like, I needed at least one other subtle reference to it.
Yeah.
So I could look back and go, oh, you know? It's like the rule of three. What happens is you have the people coughing, then you have the nurse mention it. Then you have a couple of very ambiguous things, like he coughs on the turkey leg, which you could kind of say he's choking on it because he's noticing the hot lady, you know, the witch lady that comes in.
Yeah.
And where he throws up in the Mexico ride, but he was drunk.
Yeah.
So those I don't count as your third. You need your third before you can put the kick on it.
Yeah.
And each one has to build an intensity. Yeah. So the coughing at the beginning from a story point of view. I'm just talking about building a good story. You have the subtle reference in the beginning. That's fine. You need another subtle reference that's a little bit more intense than just people coughing. Then you needed the nurse saying, oh my gosh, you know, the cat flu. Yeah. Then the ending would have worked. They needed one reference in between those two because you have to build each three in intensity. It's just called the rule of three. Does that make sense?
No, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at most good short stories or novels or movies, if it's done right, that's usually the way it works. It's just a structure thing. And that was kind of why I think I felt it was missing.
Yeah, no, that's true. Now, Abe, what's set up the MILF, the hot MILF part. Go ahead and explain what happens next. Cause this is, probably brings one of the most funniest things, that happens and some of the better lines of the film, but also it's pivotal in the sense of, as I was saying earlier, she's almost like a mirror image of him, the female version of him in desperation and, you know, life and where they wish they were.
Let me see. Well, yeah, so, they end up having sex.
Hold on. No, the setup, dude. The setup.
The setup is bizarre, yeah. So, they're sitting at a little bench, and their kids are playing around, and they're just having this seemingly normal chat. But every once in a while, Jim's eyes would dart towards this necklace, this amulet, that seems to keep his attention focused on it. He doesn't understand why, and he's trying to maintain a normal conversation with her throughout, you know, making the little fences that, you know, he compliments, and you know, he tries to explain that the necklace fascinates him. He's lost for words, and I guess he just pretty much blacks out in a way, or just comes like he loses all time beforehand and ends up in bed with her. Or right after that, he's pretty much got himself in another pickle.
Well, in the parks, the weird line there that really kind of signals that this is going to be a bizarre encounter is that she says that's not really turkey.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
it's emu.
Emu, yes, because you told people you were eating emu, no one would buy it.
Yes. Yep.
Yes.
That's not turkey, you know.
Hmm.
What you're eating? It's not turkey.
No. Well, if it's not turkey, then what is it?
You really want to know?
Well, now you have to tell me.
Emu.
What?
Emu.
Emu?
It's a bird.
Well, why don't they just call it that?
Oh, would you really buy it if they did?
No, I guess not.
Which one's yours?
Oh. Here, over there.
She's beautiful.
Thanks.
Oh, honey, she's lovely. Real princess. Looks like they're friends already.
Hmm?
Oh, the boy, he's my...
Yeah?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Oh,
cool. I'm a little longer. Thanks.
Oh, it's humid today. I don't really mind it, though.
Thank you.
Okay?
Yeah.
Has she met all the princesses yet?
She has indeed.
Don't you think it's strange that princesses pretending to be someone else, hugging all these kids?
Yeah, I guess.
I wonder what age we stop wanting to do that. Hug a perfect stranger. I suppose they aren't really strangers now, are they?
Everything all right?
What? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, your necklace. Your necklace. I meant your necklace. Sorry.
You like it?
Yeah, it's, it's
what?
I don't know. There's just something about it.
It's an heirloom. From another time.
Yeah. Wow.
Then we cut to inside her hotel room, and they're having sex, and I love when she's just riding him, and she just screams out, "I think you found my hidden Mickey."
Oh, God, that's right. Oh, that line, oh.
Yeah, she says some other bizarre lines,
too. Oh, that's right.
And then afterward, she convinces, she goes, "You know, the princesses are courtesans. Rich Asian businessmen pay fortunes to sleep with them." And it's just bizarre. Like, the whole thing is just, the conversation is just weird. Like, it's just.
It is.
Fuck me. Feel my vagina.
What the? Wait a minute.
No! I think you found my hidden Mickey. Hysterectomy.
Huh?
Oh,
sorry,
Lord. Oh, God, here it comes again.
Oh. No. Help!
Shh, wait the kids.
Sarah?
Oh, here. Let me help you. Oh, really, you like that, don't you? You're incredible. Can you believe it? They call this the presidential suite. What a joke. You're welcome to stay a while. My husband will be back till late.
No, I think I better get going. Fuck.
You know the princesses? They're high-priced courtesans.
What?
Rich Asian businessmen. They'll pay thousands for one in costume. You don't believe me? You're right. I'm joking.
Well, it was nice meeting you.
Yeah. A real blast, wasn't it?
Funny, too, is when they're out talking on the benches, and he's looking at the amulet that you mentioned, Abe, she catches him looking, and he immediately starts freaking out and gets nervous because it's almost like he was looking at her cleavage because she has low cleavage as well. And he starts going, I liked your amulet. And, you know, so the whole scene was really bizarre. The whole conversation was bizarre. But you could see he wasn't going to necessarily bail from the conversation because, first of all, she's pretty good looking. So he was going to, you know, hey, why not just talk to this person? And then he's eating anyway, and his kid is, you know, this is a chance to get away from the kid for a few minutes because the kid's entertained with the other children playing.
Right, and she also says something about which one's yours. Oh, she's such a princess, and that kind of sets up what happens later.
Yeah, it
does. And it makes you wonder if she's really obsessed with him just because she wants to get at the little girl, but we don't figure that out till later.
That's right, and. Also, the little girl doesn't even know about the relationship that the two have in, you know, basically having sex, because she's out in the other room, because this is obviously a suite type of hotel room. She's watching like this program on YouTube with the woman's son. So she's
and the
clueless.
Program was weird too. It was like these three weirdos jumping around. I was like, what is that they're watching?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
So inappropriate for kids to be watching.
Yeah, it was bizarre. It was bizarre. I mean, you know what was funniest too is that originally when I first watched the film, first like 5 minutes after the scene. Actually, when it was happening, I thought it was one of his Walter Mitty moments. And then after he flees the hotel room with his daughter, then I kind of guessed that, oh, actually, he maybe actually did go back to the hotel room and did have sex with the woman.
Well, and he takes her hotel key.
On mistake, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was unintentional because he thought it was his, because when he was looking for his items just to get the hell out of there, he took her key. And so what happens is that when he goes back to his hotel room with the daughter, he tries the key and it doesn't work. And he goes, oh, that's weird. And then he tries, he finds he has a second key on him and it works. And that's when we say, oh, he mistakenly took her key. At least that's what I got. And then, of course, the wife and the son aren't in the room. And he goes to the pool and that's where he finds them.
Yes. And this is where he pulls the glass Dumbo bell out of his swimsuit pocket.
And the wife's pissed because she wanted one of these glass souvenirs, and the same problem is she didn't want Dumbo.
She wanted Minnie Mouse.
Yeah, right.
Ungrateful
bitch. And just to echo here, that moment was added where he gives that to her, because I was listening to the commentary, and you know what Mike said, where the guy was unlikable?
Yeah.
That was added because they didn't have enough likable moments, and that was some of the feedback he got. So he added that, but at the same time, in my mind, that's like, you know, okay, he went and slept with somebody else, so he feels guilty.
Yeah.
However, he bought that glass bell before he had the encounter with this woman.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh.
So it's not like he gave it to her as a, like, I feel guilty, I bought this for you. Yeah, he bought it before he even met the woman with the turkey leg.
Well, and that's the thing too, is that at this point in the film, after he has the sexual relations with this MILF, you can figure that half the audience is immediately gonna fall off the bandwagon supporting this guy. You know, yeah. I mean, because you know, you're gonna have your typical people who just aren't like, oh my god, he's a cheater now. You know, but obviously that's not the point of the film. So you're right. I mean, at that point, a lot of people, like, whether it's Mike or anybody, are going to say, I just don't like this guy. And the cheating is just one of many moments that you could probably pick out. But you could also look at him as how I'm looking at him, which is he's just a human condition, which is what you said, Christy. So, yeah, and even then, his wife is still fighting with him because that's where I think, isn't that where the sunscreen part comes in?
Yeah, this is the whole sunscreen part.
And him not watching the boy because he's staring at the French girls.
Yeah, the Canadian girls show up at the pool, and he's like, oh, he's like following them in the pool and like flirting with them. And yeah, and so then that's when the wife comes back and says 10 minutes, because she says later that she saw that he was eyeing them.
Yeah, right. And you know what, it's somewhat disturbing because, again, I don't, how old do you think they were? Because, I mean, if they were, say, college co-eds, you could say, okay, that's just, you know, admiring good-looking chicks. But if they're under 18.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Abe? I thought they were clearly under the age of 18, but.
They look like they were, like, 16 or somewhere around there. They looked very young. I think one of them still had braces, actually.
Yes, yeah. And that's the one that he actually was after. So, you know, so eventually the wife hauls them out of the pool, and they are, and then they go to Epcot.
Yeah, right.
But wait, they go to the hotel, and she's washing the kids up. And, and he's drinking beer, and he breaks the glass and cuts he breaks the bottle of beer, and he drops it on the balcony.
Yeah.
And
he cuts his foot, doesn't he?
And he cuts his foot.
It's a nasty cut, too.
It's gross, yeah. And yeah. So then they go down into the gift shop area of the Contemporary. And he's been checking. She catches him looking at a book on French. It's like how to speak basic French or something like that.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that just goes into her figuring out that he's watching these two Quebec chicks, and she's seen them, she knows about them, and here her husband is, he's not covering it up too well.
No, not at all.
No, and then they go to Epcot, and this is when the big, wonderful scenes of him getting wasted.
Yeah.
Because they're going all around Epcot, and in every single scene, he has some kind of glass of booze in his hand.
Right, right.
While they're in the China Pavilion, he's standing on the bridge drinking booze. And then they go to the German beer garden for dinner, and the wife is trying to get the waitress to not serve him any more beer. She's like trying to rip it out of his hands, and then he's like, long live Deutschland, and yelling and all this shit. It's just a really funny scene. And she's like, don't swear in front of the kids. I'm like, you know, everything with her is don't do it in front of the kids. It's so annoying. It's like, because he keeps trying to kiss her and make out with her through the film, you know, and she keeps pushing him away, which you could argue is what enhances this obsession with these other two girls.
Well, and this is one of the things I put on the Facebook group when I was watching the film, and I said this about the wife, is he puts on one of those little Turkish-type hats.
The fezes. Yeah, my housemate has one.
Yeah, yeah. And she gets all pissed saying, put it down, stop being stupid, and blah, blah, blah. And then when they get to Mexico,
yeah,
she puts on these huge sombreros, and she's doing the same thing, but it's okay. So
yeah, for goddamn hypocrite.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like you can't, don't have fun, but I'll have fun. And I don't know. It was, you know, again, it could be just part of her anger from other things he did that pissed her off. But again, though, she's not helping the situation, because then she's, like you said, a hypocrite.
This is when he sees he's really drunk, and he sees the princesses with the Asian businessmen.
Yeah, he sees them, the various princesses, taking pictures with park revelers. Then suddenly, in his drunken state or mental state, or probably a combination of both, he suddenly sees what that woman, the MILF, told him earlier, which is that the princesses are probably really just high-priced escorts or Asian businessmen. And
yes, they show up. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And it was kind of funny. And we all know it's obvious that it's in his mind. But, I mean, again, this whole film is supposed to be his perspective and his mind breaking down. And it is one of the funnier moments of the film.
Yeah, and then they go on the Grand Fiesta Tour with the Three Caballeros in Mexico.
Yeah.
The Mexico Pavilion, which used to be the River of Time ride, or El Rio del Tiempo. But they did keep the Day of the Dead room, and this is where he has his second sort of scary, where the Day of the Dead skeleton, the music players, kind of turn into these, like, creepy, weird, ghostly-looking skeletal things with mouths.
Do you think it's part of the same idea where it's just his guilt manifesting, or is it something else?
I think it was his guilt, but also, yeah. This is right. And then his wife starts bitching at him again, and he screams, leave me alone. Yeah. And then he leans over the side of the boat and starts vomiting.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's right.
That was disgusting. Like, I was so grossed out, even though they didn't show it.
Yeah,
which is why it was gross, because you didn't see it.
Yeah, yeah, right.
It's just like, in that water
God damn.
I'm just thinking about the next time I'm on the River of Time, I better not see, or Grand Fiesta Tour, as it's called, I better not see floating vomit in the canal. That's just so disgusting. That was all I could think of. You know, I was like, ew.
That's great.
Ew. So gross. And then this is when he goes into the bathroom to clean himself up. And this is that moment that we were talking about before, Phil, where Emily sees the girl with the demon face. And, I think we already talked about. But he's in the bathroom, and he's washing out his bloody sock in the sink. And then he puts it over the hair dryer. It's so nasty.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we have, you know, innocent bystanders coming in watching him and going, son, let's get the hell out of here. Yeah, because he's basically becoming, you know, the freak that he was looking at earlier. Like, the guy in the monorail that's coughing and he rolls his eye. Like, oh, that guy's disgusting. He's now becoming one of those people, you know. He's becoming the guy in the motorized little wheelchair car. He's the guy that's coughing on the the people in the monorail, because he's now doing something stupid and disgusting as well. And
it's, yeah, and I love that moment because the guy comes in and he's like, come on, son, let's go. When he sees this disgusting thing, and the little kid goes, aren't we going to wash our hands? And the father's like, yes. Not today.
Right, that's great.
It's such a great moment. And he also runs into the guy in the wheelchair again.
That's right, he does, yeah.
And then this is where they have their giant fight, finally.
So what set this up?
My wife finally figures out, putting things together, and figures out that he's been trying to follow those quote-unquote French girls. And
yeah, because this is where she screams out, those Parisians or French or whatever the hell they are.
Yeah. And they start, and she's done. She's trying to take the kids away, and they're yelling back and forth, and he's trying to, explain his way out of it. And the kids are driving them crazy, too. The daughter wants some toy from some little game counter there. And then the mother eventually snaps and hits the daughter hard.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And eventually she just leaves because of what she did. The mother leaves the daughter with him and runs off with the son.
Right, and he also admits to her that he lost his job.
Yes, that's right.
She keeps saying, who were you on the phone with? Like, sort of implying that he's maybe cheating on her.
Right.
Like, really cheating on her and talking to someone. And he says, I lost my job. And so that's what sets her off about, no, we can't have any toys. Like, oh my God, we have no money. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So,
and that's when she smacks the kid because the kids will not stop. They're like, I want this and I want that. And she freaks out. Yeah. But you're right. That's pretty much what happens.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so this just leaves him and the daughter alone now because they run off to, she runs off to the hotel room or whatever with the boy. Is the next scene where he has another Walter Mitty moment with the French Quebec chicks where they come over to him and ask
him? No, that's coming up. The first thing they do, though, is they go to Soren. And that's when he sees the half-naked girl with the thong on the big IMAX screen.
Yes, yeah. And she plays something a big role at the end because she appears again at the very end of the film with him in another weird scene that I'm going to ask you what you think about. But, yeah, so he is, whether he's still in his drunken state or it's a combination of many things, he sees this really hot naked chick in a thong on the Soren big screen, and she talks to him, and it's a weird conversation that she says to him, because this imaginary, quote-unquote, imaginary girl talks to him. The first time I watched it, I thought it was just all imaginary, but then the second time I watched it, it's almost fits into what happens in the very last scene of the film, meaning maybe she's the real life, this is his real life, or he's now completely, it's either one of two things, his real life is with this girl,
right?
Or his real life is with the quote unquote wife we've seen, but now he's living in this fake world where this imaginary girl that he's talking to him is his new wife in this imaginary world or something. But I don't know. What did you guys think? Because the next scene is the quote unquote intermission and controversial scene that we were talking about at the beginning, the robot scene, I think, right?
Right.
Yeah. You know, it could have been his real life. It could also have been the life he wanted, perhaps. The life that was just, you know, perfect because, you know, he has kids who has very, who seem to be very mixed interactions with. The son doesn't seem to like him at all. The wife really doesn't want to have much to do with him. And, you know, and exactly what he wants in a wife. You know, I mean, as, you know, clearly what is stated during the ride when he says, what was it, a bookish type?
Yeah.
So it's very possible that it could have been the life that he wanted for himself instead.
Also, that's interesting about this imaginary girl that we now are introduced to is that his wife, his real wife, she's blonde and pretty but not gorgeous. And she's shorter and whatnot. This woman here is tall like a model, lean, Mediterranean or Latin, Hispanic looking, and obviously really, really attractive. So it's almost a complete 180 of what his wife is. Again, I don't know if that was intentional. Did they purposely look for a Mediterranean or Arabic or Latino woman to play the role or not? But I would be curious to know. Chrissy, did you know if he mentioned that in the commentary or anything?
No, he didn't mention it in the commentary. They actually were talking about something else while that whole scene was going on. So,
oh, interesting.
I get the benefit of that. But I like Abe's idea, and it never occurred to me because I'm really starting to try. I was trying to figure out the ending and what that meant. And Abe's idea makes a lot of sense because if you think about it, Disney is the land where dreams come true.
Yeah.
That's where they, so, you know, maybe this is kind of that little nod to this is his fantasy and it is, he is at the end of the film going to get the life he wants.
Yeah, right, right.
So I don't know. It didn't occur to me till Abe said it, but I'm like, you know what? That's a really good point. That's probably what's going on, I think, maybe.
Yeah, and basically it's magical realism, and that would fit perfectly to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Ending. Then they come out of Soren, and this is where the girl with the braces comes up to him.
Okay.
And I thought this scene was really interesting because he has this fantasy about, oh, she comes over and she kneels down and she kisses the daughter on both cheeks, and they leave to go on Spaceship Earth together. And then this is where you see Spaceship Earth, it comes crashing down and all these people are running and it explodes.
Right.
And then we're, so it's like a Walter Mitty moment. And then we're back and the girl is talking to him and she asks him to go with her and he says no. And I thought the Spaceship Earth blowing up was kind of cool because it was almost symbolic that his world is going to come crashing down if he does not stop chasing these chicks.
Yeah, I agree there.
Right, and it seems like at this point he knows, you know what, I already had sex with the MILF, and you know, and that was a mistake, and now I can have an opportunity to hang out with the French Quebec chicks, but he suddenly says, I can't because something bad could happen. In other words, he's basically saying, yeah, you know I've been following you all day, and obviously, you know, I think you're attractive. However, you also know that by going with you, I'm being dishonest to my wife, my family. I could do something that I probably shouldn't, you know, similar to, you know, if you get drunk, you do stupid things on mistake. And he basically tells this girl this, and her reaction is she gets pissed and she spits on him. But the question is, was she approaching him just to be a wise ass? Because she knew he was following her.
Yeah, see, that's what I was going to bring up, because I really think that this scene could be read one of two ways.
Yeah, I think so.
Did this conversation happen between them and she spits on him because he says no? Or does she just realize that he's following her, gets creeped out, comes up and spits on him, and he actually imagined the entire conversation?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So maybe there's three things. One is she really wanted him to hang out because, it, you know, whatever, for whatever reason, because, you know, why not have a guy, when someone likes me, have him around. Or yeah, it could be she was just playing with him because she knew this guy's a dork or a weirdo and, hey, let's play with him and say, hey, why don't you come with us, blah, blah, blah. In reality, she was just going to go, ha, ha, and run away or whatever. And then the third is, you're right, it could have all been in his mind, the conversation, and she just came right up to him and spat on him.
And that, I don't know about you guys, but that scene where she spits is disgusting.
Yeah, well, they do it in slow motion.
So gross.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not just like spit, it's like a giant
Moogie, yeah.
Moogie. Like.
And so then they run off laughing. And at this point, these two Quebec chicks have already hooked up with random guys in the park anyway. So, yeah, I mean, they're not there just to have fun on rides. They're obviously there to, you know, party and whatever anyway. So they take off. And this is where we get another Walter Mitty moment, right? Where he gets zapped by tasers from security.
Yes, and he's lost his daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
He thinks the daughter's wandered away. He's lost track of her. And as he's frantically searching for her, that's when these two people come up and they taser him and they capture him. And they're in these awesome outfits. They're almost like these Logan's Run, like
1950s type outfits. Yes. I was thinking that too, actually.
They're just so interesting. And then we cut to intermission. And then after intermission is when we have, he wakes up and he's in this lab and we find out that he's under Spaceship Earth. And that was that scene that we were talking about where we were like, does this subplot even need to be in here?
Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting things about it. I mean, obviously, on the wall is pictures of that hot naked chick that he'd seen in Soren. And then the room's all white. And then, of course, we have the scientist. And, of course, we find out that he's a robot when he escapes and cracks him.
Well, and there's also pictures on the walls of all of his memories.
Yeah, that's
right. I was wondering what most of those things were.
Yeah.
But I think in talking this through, which still this shouldn't be as confusing as it is without talking it through. But the scientist, who's wonderful, by the way, his acting is just amazing. You just buy him hook, line, and sinker, you know?
Yep.
He says, oh, you're the first person, you're the first outsider here. And so if we connect that to the end, because there's the naked woman, the kind of scantily clad woman he saw in Soren on the walls, maybe what they're doing is they're trying to manifest people's dreams coming true. But see, that's not made clear, and that's a wild guess. I still think you could have cut that whole subplot out, but...
But you know what, though? Based off of how the ending occurs... No, actually, you're right. You still could probably cut it out because the ending really more relates to the Soren scene, not this scene.
Right.
Yeah. So either way, it's one of the more confusing scenes, and anybody who's seen this film, if you guys want to write it down your opinions of this scene on the Facebook Dark Discussions podcast page, please do. We would love to hear what you guys have to say about it. So Michelle Barkley and Kevin Letts and everybody, let us know what you think on the Facebook Dark Discussions podcast page, what you guys think of this scientist robot scene in this film. Because I know most of them are probably going to go watch the film, because I know Kevin Letts said he was going to, and Michelle will probably want to after hearing our episode.
And the other thing, too, I would love to hear what they think, because I think, like I said, it could be cut out, but in relation to the way I just sort of put it together with the ending in my head, you could technically leave the scene in as long as the scientist says very clearly and flat out, you're the first person we're trying this with. We're going to make your dreams come true. That's all he has to say. The whole thing makes sense. The ending makes sense.
Right.
Just add that one line, but the scene as it stands is just way too confusing and, you know, because it's just not stated clearly what they're trying to do.
No, it isn't.
I mean, we're talking it through three different people who've seen the scene, and we're still not figuring out how it fits with the ending or any other part, really, except that it's confusing. I mean, that's really all we can say. I mean, it's an interesting scene, and you know that he's trying to say something, meaning the director, screenwriter, but I just can't figure out what it is. I'm sure if we all went on Google and really did some research and stuff, but at the moment, most of it, there's not much about the film giving away things like this. It's more just reviews of the film, and I haven't been able to find like a critical piece on the film. So it would be curious what other people that's seen it, other perspectives, to see what they have to say.
Yeah, and I think the guess that we're sort of making now about the dreams coming true would also work, would also make the most sense, because at the end, remember, you have that other robot guy after the father dies, and he puts his hand on the kid's head and sees Buzz Lightyear and gives him the Buzz Lightyear pin.
Yeah.
Because remember, the kid never got to go on the Buzz Lightyear ride, and that was his big dream. That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah, that's actually a valid point. Yeah.
So by giving him the pin, it's almost like saying you went on the Buzz Lightyear ride, even if you didn't.
Yeah, right.
But again, so we're all reaching.
Yeah, exactly. This idea or this hypothesis that you're presenting seems pretty good. And yeah, it'd be curious to see if other people agree with it, never mind see something else that we're not seeing. So.
Yeah, and then we have the whole sexual thing of him escaping where he takes the geosporic and he sprays it and it's all like semen.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, in the commentary, I watched the film and made my notes about all the phallic symbols in the commentary. Before I watched the commentary, but listening to the commentary, they talk about all these things. They did it deliberately.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
It was very deliberate. And they're like, oh, it's like a big semen fest and blah, blah, blah. And it kind of was. All this white stuff coming out of everywhere. And even where he's holding the tube, like he's holding the tube kind of down near his lap. It's just.
Oh my God, I'm kidding. Yeah. And yeah. You know what's funny is that a lot of films, we do have surprisingly good symbolism that wasn't intended, or things that weren't intended that appear and are really good. You know, for example, you know, the Living Dead films by George Romero, a lot of times people have read into things that he's saying this or this about society or whatever. And then eventually by certain parts in the trilogy, the first trilogy, he decides to say, yeah, you know what, I'm going to play into those. But originally it was just luck, you know, like he put a African American as the lead in Night of the Living Dead, and you could say that was a symbolism of something, and you know, that was just luck. And this film here, I could see the director, screenwriter, him doing everything intentional. I mean, it's one of those films that's filled with symbolism, and the point of it is to be filled with symbolism. That is the main thing about this film, is there's a lot of hidden messages as well as obvious messages that he intended. And so I can't see anything but all these things to be done on purpose. I mean, yeah. I'm sure there may be a few that weren't, but yeah, most of them have to be. I mean, the story, the screenplay, how we put it together, I mean, it would be too coincidental if they were just fluky.
Yeah, exactly. And then I totally agree with you. That makes total sense. And then we have the moment where he kills the doctor by chopping his head off, and it's a robot.
Yep.
And I thought that the robot's head landing on the ground, the first thing I thought of was The Empire Strikes Back, where Luke cuts off the head of Darth Vader, and it turns out to be himself.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, yeah.
That was just the first thing that struck me. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I was like, oh, damn, that's so cool. <It's> like,
and Star Wars is now owned by Disney, too.
Yes, it is. And
irony.
And you know what was weird, too, though, about this scene? At the end, he gets the recorded phone call from his boss. That was bizarre. I didn't understand what that was about. And it's a recording of it's the same recording. In other words, at the beginning, he's standing in the contemporary, gets the call from his boss saying he's fired.
Yes.
You believe he's having a real conversation.
Right.
But then after this scene, he escapes through like a manhole tunnel, comes up out of a manhole, and his phone rings, and it's part of the conversation. It's like, so it's obvious that the boss's phone call at the beginning was a recording.
Oh, yeah.
You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I didn't get that at all.
Well, that's the thing, is that the first hour of the film, and that's what we all discussed at the beginning of this episode, was that seemed in the real world, and you know, even if there was quirky moments or whatever, everything occurred seemed like it was legitimately truthful and factual. And then we hit certain parts that are Walter Mitty things, but you know, that's just little dream moments, whatever. But then we hit the intermission scene, and then we go into like the psychedelic phase of the movie. And when I say psychedelic, I don't mean, you know, like 1960s drug use. I'm talking about, we don't now know what's real and what's not real. Because, you know, if he's coming out of a manhole and then he gets a phone call, is the phone call also fake too? Because you know he didn't come out of a manhole, right? Unless...
Oh, yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Yeah. And that's because at this point, everything now from the intermission to the end is all like surreal rather than real anymore. Because, you know, we have everything that occurs is weird. Because, you know, you have a guy coming out of a manhole. We have these him getting the cat flu. We have people coming and taking him away, and then we have that very end scene, and all of it is surreal. I don't know what's real. I mean, I can arguably say that none of it's real except maybe the last 5 minutes, the last scene from intermission on, but I don't know.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and he comes up out of the manhole cover, and he's looking for his daughter.
Yep.
And I really like this scene where he's running through the Epcot fireworks and the way the people are standing there, like the two Quebec girls and their little boyfriends that they picked up are yep. standing there kind of like holding hands. It's just a very interesting, the way the crowd is kind of staged is interesting. And then he sees the guy in the wheelchair again.
Yep.
And they get into this big fight. And he says something about, and this was also kind of messed me up. I don't know what you guys think about, but the guy in the wheelchair says, "Oh, you just made me drop my turkey leg." And then Jim says, "It's emu."
Yeah.
And then the next thing we see is he's on a launch, one of the boat launch. And he's on the boat launch going, he's going to her hotel, which turns out to be the Dolphin. But, you know, we see the Yacht and Beach Club resort in the background. So, you know, he left through the International Gateway or whatever. There's all these ways to get around Disney World by boat. So he goes toward the Dolphin Hotel where the witch is, and he still has her key. But I don't know what the trigger moment was for him to go to the witch.
Well,
there's a realization moment there missing or something. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's the thing too, because again, this whole second half or last half hour, whatever it is interesting, because whether it's intentionally surreal, whether it's just let's move along quicker, I don't know. But I mean, for example, with the turkey leg versus the, and he says, "Oh, it's emu." Earlier, he said he has a turkey leg, and someone else said it's emu, and he's like, yeah, whatever. And now he's buying into it. Or, and so in other words, he's live now on the other side of the dream wall or whatever, because he's now saying, "Oh, it's emu, it's not turkey." And then he somehow figures out that his daughter's with the quote unquote witch. He gets to the hotel room, and then we hear her backstory, the witch's backstory, and she's, talks about how she used to be a princess and now she's a witch. And
oh, I loved this. Where she caught the kid to death. That was
awesome. Yeah, Jesus. You hear the bones breaking too. It's like, oh. Jeez.
And she's like, and they have her dressed up in this cheesy princess costume that they obviously got from, like, you know, Party Stop or something like that.
Yeah, right. Because, you know, the boobs are hanging out and all this other stuff. And it's like, oh, Lord. And the thing is that she basically explains the desperation of life in her whole story.
Yes.
And he, meaning Jim, he's almost like feeling like sorry or horrified at her, which is interesting because he's basically doing the same thing as her, feeling the same way as her. But now the movie's almost making it like he's the prince coming to save the princess, and the princess happens to be his daughter. And right. And obviously Moore, the director, screenwriters, is trying to say something there. And then the quote-unquote witch, she says that, "Oh, I was just playing. I mean, don't you want to play and have fantasies and wish you had a different life and whatever, whatever?" And it literally goes over his head because of the moment, you know, because his daughter had been quote-unquote gone, kidnapped, whatever you want to say, and he's all flustered and angry and whatever. But if he was in a better state of mind, he would have probably read everything she was saying, which is, don't you wish you had a different life? Don't you wish your life was better? Don't you wish you could be someone else? And all of it goes over his head because he just wants to get his daughter and get the hell out of it.
Yeah, and she also says something very poignant, too. She says, "It's impossible to be happy all the time."
Yeah.
Which is true, yeah.
Yeah.
which for me, that line really stuck out. And I'm still not sure. It's almost like at that moment when she says that line, but you're right, he completely doesn't hear her message.
Right.
Because it's almost like that's the thing that he needs to hear so that he can forgive himself of his guilt.
Yes.
Of sleeping with her and, you know, whatever. So there's the whole piece that you're talking about going on in that scene. But yeah, there's also this other piece.
And he's, the problem with him too is that he's picturing her as quote unquote bad. And, you know, because, oh, you're the one that wanted to cheat with a married man and you're the one that took my daughter and blah, blah, blah. And yet in reality, I think that's misplaced because what it is that she is basically him and he just doesn't see it. I mean, they're almost mirror images of themselves where, you know, they're both in lives they don't like. They both wish they had a different, you know, thing to do or be something better or whatever. And instead of him seeing that, he just says, you know, you're crazy, you're this, you're that. And really what he's doing, it seems to me, is that he's really just saying he doesn't even understand himself. By not understanding her, he doesn't understand himself or where he is in life.
Yeah. Yeah, that scene is loaded.
Oh, yeah.
That is a loaded, loaded scene.
And then when the amulet breaks and everybody's like, oh my God, what happened? And then she even says, oh, it's just even though it was this heirloom, it's really, you know, just a worthless piece of junk. And I don't know. There's just so much in there that, I mean, I wish I could have rewatched that one scene so it would be more fresh in my mind so we could talk about it even more.
Yeah, there was a lot to take in there.
Yeah, yeah. Because even that amulet breaking and its symbolism and then, it's not even important, really, for the whole scene.
Well, it's just the shattering. It represents the shattering of the illusion.
Yeah.
As you just pointed out, he can't see.
Yeah, yeah. And it is an illusion because when it breaks, you know, everybody, she's upset at first, but then, if I'm not mistaken, she goes, well, it's just part of my, I'm not really a witch or anything. This is just part of my fantasy, you know? I mean, yeah. And that's it. And he's still like clueless and he's still looking at her as crazy rather than understanding what she means and how it reflects on him.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And now we're actually at the wind down to the end.
Yep.
He goes back, he takes his daughter back to the contemporary. And we do almost get the sense that he maybe has transformed a little bit.
Yeah.
He still doesn't understand himself, but like he sings to his daughter. It's almost like he's making peace with what he has or he's defeated or something. But there's definitely some kind of shift that happened. And then basically that's when he gets hit with the cat flu.
Well, this is the funniest thing is so he gets the diarrhea and all this other stuff. And the thing is, you know what's hilarious? It's typical for all movies, at least sometimes. I mean, now it's a little different. I mean, Game of Thrones and a few other things have both. But when he's doing his John Crapper crap, they digitize out his ass.
Oh, well, explain that in the commentary.
Yeah, I want to know why because
you know why?
Because they have the hot girl and they show her completely naked.
Okay. No, because the actor did not want to remove his underwear.
Really?
Yes. Oh,
so the underwear was still there.
The underwear was still there. That's why they digitized it out.
Huh.
And he said that he didn't want to take off his shorts, and we were like, okay, whatever. You know, so we just said, we'll digitize it out.
Okay.
And that's why. And they clearly explained that in the commentary, because they were laughing about it. They're like, we put these actors through so much crap, and the poor guy wanted to keep his pants on. So we just went, oh, you know what? Okay.
There was nothing to it except for that. That's too funny.
No, it really was. And, you know, when you look at the making of, there's a making of feature on the DVD.
Yeah.
And the cast actually talks about how stressful it was to be sneaking around Disney World and how many times they almost got caught.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's really fascinating. Like on the DVD, there's a whole thing where they're like, they almost got caught and a couple times. And
well, especially with two of the actors being little kids, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So it was really kind of interesting. So that was why that happened. They just decided to let him pass and say, you know what? Enough. We don't care. We'll just get excited about it.
That's funny. Now, this is another surreal moment because when he's quote unquote dying of the cat flu, his son actually comes into the bathroom and he goes, you know, he's basically saying, "Help me!" And the son just shuts the door on his.
Yeah, I love that moment.
Yeah.
Oh my god,
it's so heart wrenching and sad, but it's basically like the son is finished. He's like, "I'm done with you being distant." I don't know that it just makes such a powerful statement there.
Yeah.
And I will say that the effects of this cat flu scene, it's classic. They're in black and white, but all of that blood that's all over them, it's still really visceral and toe curling, even though it's in black and white, because it was done so well.
Right. The thing that makes it surreal then is the fact that not only is he dead, or appears to be dead, but his eyes turn into basically like Siamese
cat eyes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Little slits and everything.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and then of course, what happens next? The quote unquote security or
cleanup crew comes in.
Yeah, and they take him away and whatever. And so let's just wrap it up here. What happens? What goes on?
Well, basically, we see this wonderful montage. First of all, when he dies, there's this. In the next, we don't know that he's died. We don't see that he's died. We see the son shut the door.
Yep.
And there's almost like the same funereal music that we heard at the beginning.
Yep.
We hear sort of reminiscent of it at the end. It's not the same, but it's close. So it's got that same kind of tone to it.
Yep.
Almost like a dirge. And we see this beautiful montage of the empty parks. You know, it's morning. We see empty Cinderella Castle, empty Epcot, empty Mission Space, empty Mexico Pavilion, empty China Pavilion. Essentially, many of the places that they were are now vacant and empty. So, and then in the hotel, Emily, the wife, wakes up and finds him dead in the bathroom. And there's just blood everywhere. And he's got this weird grin on his face.
Yep.
And his eyes are crossed. And I thought that was very disturbing. That image was really disturbing. And that's when the security comes.
Exactly. It's just that they come and they're dressed weird and they act weird, like almost like robotic.
Yeah. It's almost like they were also robots like the professor was.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's almost unceremonious, his taking away. And then I don't know what happens. Then does it just flash to that final scene where.
Well, no, what happens is that the three robots come in. They take the body away. This is when you have that moment where the lead robot guy or the lead security guy spends a moment with the boy.
Yep.
He puts a hand on the boy's head. He like sees the flashes of Buzz Lightyear then he gives him the pin. And Emily, the wife, is hugging the Dumbo bell and crying.
Yep.
And then you see them cleaning up the room.
Yep.
Like they're cleaning up the room almost like they're prepping it.
For the next people.
But it's almost got a sinister feel to it. It's almost like, oh, we're going to do this to the next family that comes into this room. It's got a very foreboding kind of feel to it.
Yeah, right. Because you would think it would just be, you know, a chambermaid or whatever. And it's
right. Like, exactly. And the fact that they're doing it is, you know, and then they bring out the body. And like you said, it's very unceremonial, but it's intercut. Now, here's what's interesting. We see them cleaning. Bringing out the body very unceremoniously and smoking cigarettes.
Yep.
They're bringing out the body, all standing there smoking cigarettes, lighting up each other's cigarettes.
Yep.
And these things are all intercut with shots of the park opening for the day.
Yeah, right.
People running in. So again, we have a mirror of the opening credits.
Yeah, right.
Where we saw the daylight and the night. And here again, we're seeing the daylight, the happy, the external, and the night. And in this case, it's these guards, these security people that are covering up like, ooh, we got to get rid of this really quietly. And that's when we see the car pull up with the chick that was in Soren, and Jim gets out of the car with a little girl in his arms. And she has dark hair, just like his original daughter had dark hair in The Small World. Remember where he got that flash?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So that's how the movie ends. The bellhop says, oh, are you checking in? And they go, yes. And the happy family of three enters the contemporary resort. And the bellhop guy eyes the white van pulling away from the curb.
And what does that mean, you think?
The white van has the body of Jim. Jim's body in
yeah.
it. Oh, his old self.
His old self, yeah.
Yeah, and the guy, the way he looks, the guy looks at the van is like he knows his routine, you know?
Yeah, yes, that's a good point.
Yeah, and another thing that was interesting, too, is when Jim comes out of the car with his, quote-unquote, new family, unlike his old family where he looked like the... you know, the bare belly, pizza belly, t-shirt guy with the Bermuda shorts. He comes out, or, you know, the guy you would see basically at Walmart or a Little League game. Instead, now he comes out with the Bermuda shirt and the sunglasses and a nice, cool-looking hat.
Yeah.
And he's hip. You can tell he has money and he has the lovely family around him. So he's completely different now. And so that's another contrast, too, compared to the Jim that's leaving in the white van.
Yeah.
Now, before we figure out what all that means, I just had one quick question for you. Like the toilet scene where he dies as the with the cat flu and various other things like the nurse's office and whatnot, I assume those scenes aren't actually filmed in the park, right? I mean, you said once that some of the scenes were filmed at like a Holiday Inn down near the park or whatever. I assume the nurse scene obviously wasn't in the park.
Yes, they said that the exterior shot of that was the first aid center in Disneyland.
Okay.
Not Disney World. In Disneyland, it's right there in the middle.
Yeah.
Like you saw it. In Disney World, it's kind of tucked away in a corner. You got to kind of know where it is.
But the inside itself.
The inside, they said, was shot at some office building.
Yeah, right.
Probably in L.A.
Yep.
The interior of the witch's hotel room.
Yep.
I think that was shot at a hotel in L.A. too. That was not shot on property.
Yeah.
And the, like I said, the interior hallway scenes of the contemporary, those were shot at that hotel, that Palms Resort or whatever it was out in California.
Right.
What else did they? They did a lot of things green screen, like yep. The girls running towards Space Mountain. That was all green screen.
Oh, the boy vomiting in the mailbox thing was a green screen.
Yeah.
Also this whole scene where he meets the MILF, that was all green screened.
Yep. And also, where he meets, yes, that was green screened, where he meets the guy in the wheelchair on Tom Sawyer Island.
Yep.
That was filmed in a park in California somewhere.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, if you really listen to the commentary and watch the movie, I mean, before I watched the commentary, I had pretty much done a lot of research and figured out, like, what was filmed where in terms of Disneyland versus Disney World.
Yeah, sure.
But I knew right away that the Witch's Hotel Room could not have been filmed in Disney World because I'm like, there are no hotel interiors that look like that there. I know that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's to a park freak, it's really obvious, but they did a really good job. And they minimized, I think they were smart to minimize how much time they spent in the parks. They certainly did spend a lot of time there, but they did do some smart, you know, they did kind of some smart
green screens, some smart interiors,
where they could, and yeah, and I think if I'm not mistaken, I think the guy said in the commentary that a lot of the crowd scenes were where they did green screen stuff
because
it's too obvious for them to.
Yeah, people start raising eyebrows.
Yeah.
Now, the ending again. Any further things we wanted to talk about that? Because it is interesting. I mean, there's the two gyms, one going away, the old gym, which was the Walmart, Little League, father type crap. And then there's the hip gym coming out of the car with the quote-unquote wife that's good-looking, that probably loves him, with a daughter that's perfect, and he probably has money and all that. Obviously, you look at it, like you said, it's Disney World making the dreams come true, which...
And maybe they were his first candidate.
Yeah. And that probably works better than my first idea, which is his real life was that originally, because we wouldn't have had the robot people and you know, the, as you said, Abe, the sly look of the guy as the van is taken away and things like that. So again, obviously, you know, the whole second half is a completely different type of film than the first. I mean, the fairy princess part and the witch part, you could argue was in the real world, because the way she talks, the witch, she makes it sound like, oh, I'm just having fun, you know, whatever, it's real world. But everything between that scene from the intermission to the end is very surreal. And again, it probably, yeah, I mean, you could guess, I mean, I think it was you, Christy, that came up with the idea that the Disney and this is making dreams come true. And that ending or that explanation sounds legit to me.
Yeah, I mean, it just occurred to me as we were all trying to hash it out. I was like, you know, maybe that is what's going on. But I still maintain that it should have been made perfectly clear. You know, it's one of those moments where, and, you know, I know I've mentioned this on podcasts before, possibly even yours, but I had a professor who always told me, you know, make sure that the movie that's playing in your head is the one that actually makes it to the page when you write.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means you just have to state something
Totally
clear and upfront so that your audience knows what's going on.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you think it was disingenuous, that ending, because it leaves out the wife and his original two kids? Obviously, you could say the kid got his dream, which, because he got the Buzz Lightyear thought and pin and all that. And so, you know, everybody is individual, even though they're quote unquote a family, we're still individuals. And, the old phrase, everybody dies alone, you know, no matter how many people love you or how many family members you have around, you still die alone or whatever. I mean, in a sense, is that you could argue is the case. So everybody has their own ending individually, and it doesn't matter that they're a family and they were connected at one time. But you could also say it's disingenuous too, because, I mean, even though the wife was quote unquote a bitch, she's not evil. And Jim was definitely not the best husband as you could see. So what's your opinion of the fate of the three characters that weren't the quote unquote main lead?
It's hard to say, you know, it could be that in some way they found their happy ending maybe. And they weren't, and that's why they weren't, you know, sought out by whatever system control is within the Disney mm-hmm. corporation, you know. Maybe because he was so miserable that he stood up above all the other weirdos there.
Oh, that's a really good point. That's a good point. And in a way, the family did get what they wanted. I mean, you know, the little boy got his Buzz Lightyear. The wife, yeah, you're right, she bitched and moaned, but she wasn't evil. But still, she was so cold toward him and rolling her eyes. And, you know, you almost wonder if she wanted to be rid of him.
Yeah.
So she got her wish, kind of, if that's really true. But I think I could make a case for that. I could argue for that. I think there's enough evidence in the film to prove that she is disgusted with her life as well and wants a change. And the little girl gets her wish because she understands that her father loves her.
Yeah, that's true. That's actually
true. Right? And, you know, there's that conversation. And she also got to be a princess.
Yeah, that's
true. So she got her ending, too. So, yeah, I could totally go with that, Abe. I could totally go with that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, That sounds legit too. I mean, again, there's so many different interpretations, and I, you know, I haven't thought of long and hard enough to think of any of them myself, except for what we've been saying tonight. But I mean, I'm glad I'm talking out with other folks here, because yeah, these all sound legit to me. And now, any last thoughts on the film before we wrap up? Hey, why don't you go first?
It's definitely a film you've got to see more than once, you know, to catch little things here and there, or if you haven't caught everything the first time. But it's got a very interesting history to it. It's the fact that it's one of the most impressive guerrilla films, you know, out there that I can think of. It's well shot, it's got some great acting, bizarre visuals, and it does have interesting themes. So, although, you know, it's going to, the reactions are very from person to person, I still give it a recommendation for people to check out and give it a shot. So it's got a thumbs up from me here.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, for me, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was very humorous at many points. I thought the story was really interesting at many points. Obviously, there's a couple of flaws here and there that doesn't make the film perfect. But for a first-time motion picture full-length feature, I thought it was really good. Definitely a recommend, though I recommend it probably to a certain select audience because it's definitely an art house film more than a mainstream film. And it's definitely not the type of genre horror speculative fiction that everybody would like, so you can't expect certain things. Basically, you summed it up pretty much, Christy. It's called magical fantasy. Which, if people know what that is, you know, then you're all set, and that's what you should expect. And it is a well done version of that, and as a result, I would recommend it. Just make sure you go in expecting that more than it being a true horror or science fiction type film, more magical fantasy. So yeah. Good film. Yeah. What about you, Christy?
Oh, I definitely give this a recommend. I pretty much have everything that I would want to say about it. Pretty much, you guys just both said. I think there's some wonderfully darkly funny moments in it. I think it's very provocative. It has a lot to say. This is a thinking person's film. And if you, because there's just so